Welcome to All Time to Listen and Terry. Hi to Kathy and Ed, and I won't forget Mary. To talk about culture, humanities, and art, all we need is for Spectrum West to start. A good mid-October howdy to y'all. I'm Al Ross, and this is where you'll find conversation about and people engaged in something we do very well in Western Wisconsin. We entertain ourselves and cultivate our surroundings. This week, we talk with Wayne Bergeron, a trumpet player who seems to hit all the high notes in life and while playing. He's guesting with the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra Friday night. Jim Oliver's here with a full list of what's on stage in West Wisconsin and with a special guest, Caroline Fraser, winner of big literary prizes and an invitee at this year's Chippewa Valley Book Festival happening now. We'll meet, greet, and hear the sweet sound of Annie Mack, a lady who writes and sings what she feels, appearing Friday night at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. And to open this week's production, the Flyway Film Festival. It's provided 10 years of filling small-town venues along the Mississippi River with fans of film, the long and short of it. But this year, the 11th affair is different. The instigators have moved on to other projects, and the popcorn popper has been passed to those who simply did not want to see it end. It's come too far, become too popular, and has gained big-time recognition. The interim executive director is Lou Lippold. She's been a Mississippi Valley Arts Champion for quite a while now. She was big-hearted enough to take time out from a frenzied final few days of planning to fill us in. This is the 11th festival, and like many 11-year-olds, it's in a time of transition. Lou Lippold, tell us what's happening with the festival and the organization and the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Well, we're all in a tizzy right now preparing for the festival, which starts Friday. What's happened throughout 2018 is we created a new board of directors. We incorporated as a nonprofit called the Flyway Film Society. So we basically kind of started from scratch, kind of scaled back to a weekend long instead of a 3 to 4 day festival. But a lot of the traditions remain. The name Flyway, for one thing, which sure refers to the Mississippi River Flyway, migration path for birds, and the tradition of supporting emerging independent filmmakers. So we're screening a lot of things that have been on the festival circuit, meaning they've been to a lot of film festivals or are very new on the film festival circuit with us. Mm-hmm. We're screening both national, international, and regional, local films. So, yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, we're all excited about that. We've all heard the adage, change is good. How does Lou Lippold feel about the accuracy of that line? You will undoubtedly learn some things about yourselves and the festival this year. Is that what you're anticipating?
Some of those things cannot be said politely on the radio.
Okay, then don't try.
But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a learning experience for everyone on the board. Most people had not had really much experience with film festivals at all, except for attending and maybe volunteering a little bit, but really like film festivals and see what a great thing this is for our community. Rick and Diana, who ran the thing double-handedly by themselves mostly for the first several years, really established a national and international reputation for this festival with really interesting guests and bringing in interesting filmmakers and films. So, yeah, we want to build on those successes and that reputation. The question is, how do you do that with a mostly volunteer nonprofit and the struggle with funding, of course, as any nonprofit struggles with? So.
You bet. There just has to be a lot of nuts and bolts part of this whole process. And hopefully those nuts and bolts were in tidy little jars when you took over. I'm guessing not all of them were. And I can imagine what it must be like for you as the interim executive director. First of all, there are schedules and submissions and people calling you who you have not talked to before, and they have to kind of bring you up to speed on their past affiliations or their aspirations in participating with the festival. Man, talk about hitting the ground running.
Al, you sound like you have a good grasp of what it takes, so maybe you would like to take on the executive directorship next year.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, if you don't, give me a call.
Okay.
So now to the Flyway Film Festival nut. Is this year going to feel different to them? Probably in positive ways.
Well, I think any festival reflects the preferences of the people who are doing the programming, obviously. And since I and a couple other people, including my daughter Mira, who is a filmmaker in Austin, Texas, worked on the programming, it does reflect our interests. Let me say one thing. 73% of the films we're screening this year have a woman in the director's chair.
Well, there you go.
And that's different and unusual. We had a lot of feedback from the community over the years. They wanted, well, some people put it like this, do I have to feel like killing myself after every movie? Because there tended to be a sort of a dark theme. And, you know, again, we have a wide variety of moods, you might say, in the films we're showing. But yeah. I think there might be a little more.
Yeah,
positive.
I've never liked films that just left me hanging or feeling terrible. More Pollyanna.
Well, I would say Pollyanna because that's just really not a thing. An independent film, mostly.
Sure. Well, bad choice of names there.
Yeah. I mean, they're complex characters. There's a lot of funny stuff. We got a lot of good comedy. The documentaries are just amazing. I mean, there's some that will just blow your mind. So check out the programs.
We're on the phone with Lou Lippold. She is the interim executive director of the Flyaway Film Festival, now in its 11th year. It's this weekend, big party Friday night, and then films Saturday and Sunday spread throughout Stockholm, Pepin, and Alma, Wisconsin. I described in some promos the festival as leaner and meaner this year. Meaner used in a kind way, you know, as in bad means good nowadays. Mean can mean convenient. You feel that way? You feel lighter? Or do you feel what?
Having it be a shorter fest, I mean, in a way that makes it trickier for audiences because, like, I want to see all of these, but a lot of them are screening at the same time. But in terms of putting it together, programming, finding volunteers, it is somewhat of a relief to have it a little bit shorter. And also, we're Saturday in 3 venues and Sunday only 2, so that helps us coordinate some of the logistics. On Friday, it's the opening night party. No film screening on Friday. Saturday and Sunday are full-on film screenings.
You have been, you meaning the festival, on Movie Maker Magazine's prestigious 25 coolest film festivals in the world. Are you, with the remake this year, feeling secure about your coolness?
Boy, that's a tricky question. You know, if you have to talk about how cool you are, does that make you less cool? I don't know. So I think that we will just bask in the knowledge that we are doing an amazing job programming excellent films and let the world judge us from there.
Good. Good idea. And we'll direct them to the website just before we say ta-ta. But tell us the venues. What are the venues in Stockholm, Pepin, and Alma that people are going to want to visit?
The venue in Stockholm is the Widespot Performing Arts Center, which is worth a visit regardless of what's happening there, film festival or other concerts. It's a beautiful old, well, it's been a lot of things, but started out as an opera house and now it's a performing arts center.
Uh-huh.
It's up a steep flight of stairs, but it's very beautiful. Pepin is a little venue called The Minima. It is in the process of becoming what we hope will be a year-round screening venue. Small storefront next to E&S Grocery on 2nd Street in Pepin. So sometimes it's a theater and sometimes the chairs are moved around for it to be something else, but
okay.
It's a very nice place to watch a movie. And then in Alma, the Big River Theater is a beautiful old historic theater, again, a performing arts and film venue.
Yes, I've spent a lot of time backstage and on stage.
So you have.
That's just a lot of fun. Okay, so finally, Lou, give us the website address so that people can have a little dessert after this conversation and get all of the nuts and boltsy information they need to partake this weekend.
All right. It is flywayfilmfestival.org, and that's Flyway, F-L-Y. W-A-Y, not fly away. Sometimes people say, I can't find your website. Well, it's not fly away. It's Flyway. A lot of the tickets are going fast. Things are going to sell out. So it's a really good idea to go online and make sure you buy your tickets online. It's the same price at the door, but you might not get in at the door because the venues are pretty small.
Okay. Lou Lippold, first of all, congratulations for having the fortitude to take over as interim executive director. The word interim can be scary sometimes. And then and then thank you on behalf of people who love the Flyaway Film Festival and have for a long time for being willing to do that. And have fun this weekend.
Well, thank you very much, Al, and I hope we see you there.
Come Monday, have fun resting.
That I definitely plan to do.
The Flyaway Film Festival survives, evolves, and with your support, flourishes. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota with the all-wheel drive RAV4, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from Chan Hassen Dinner Theaters with the 50th anniversary production of Irving Berlin's Holiday Inn, the new Broadway musical featuring seven holidays from Thanksgiving to the 4th of July. ChanhassenDT.com. Support also comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory. October features Bruce Kaupanger's Raku Pottery, Earl Duckett's Nature Photography, and Emily Gray Kohler's Woodblock Prints. More at artzgallery.org. You may not have heard of Annie Mac before today, but you can now say that you've heard her sing.
You say you want love, joy and peace too, but you run and hide when they come calling on you. You say you're tired of suffering, you just want a better life. When the truth comes to set you free, you stay shackled to the lies. I don't know if you're ready to lay your burdens down.
Annie Mac fronts the Annie Mac Band, which comes in various varieties, one of which, the down and dirty acoustic Tell It Like It Is version, visits the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls Friday evening. We shared some phone time the other day talking about some tough beginnings, a mother who brought music into the house, and more.
Wants to help you.
Now, when we talk about blues and gospel, we probably should uncover some roots. They often run deep. Tell us about Annie Mac, the singer, where and how that all got started, and then how you slid into the kind of music you love. That often has to do with someone close and a congregation. Am I warm there?
Well, I think that's a big part of why my story is a little bit different, is I did not grow up in the church, and I was not in a choir.
Ah.
So I did grow up in a home that loved and celebrated music. We had a really awesome record player. My mother and my sister and I were kind of, that was our entertainment. We grew up very humble. So we didn't have cable television or anything like that. So she had this really beautiful record collection that was just so diverse and such a representation of her love of music. You know, anything from Dolly Parton to Crystal Gayle to The Temptations to Dr. John to Aretha Franklin to Gladys Knight, Bobby Bland. I mean, you name it, my mother had it. And so she understood the genius of artists. And it didn't matter what their genre was. So to grow up listening to Etta James or even, you know, Rod Stewart, I took it for granted. I didn't realize, you know, that maybe that's not the most common thing. People's perceptions, you know, a lot of times of African-Americans, or, you know, can be pretty limiting. Even, you know, where you're from. I'm from the Midwest, you know. Mm-hmm. So can I start a fire in the blizzard? Probably, you know, if I had to survive, if I had to survive, I probably could. So. And that's what I grew up with, and those are the things that touched me. The music that really touched me, honestly, she loved Mahalia Jackson, so we did listen to gospel, and she loved the gospel of Aretha Franklin when Aretha was young and really raw. You know what I'm saying? Like,
sure.
We could just hear that explosive power. As every artist, they get older, they smooth out, and it kind of, but she loved Aretha Franklin, Bridge Over Troubled Waters. I was moved to tears as a child, and I didn't understand why. We weren't religious, and we didn't go to church or anything. Mm-hmm. I still get that feeling when I hear Eva Cassidy. So there's people that I believe are touched that have that, you know, they do call it the anointing, and it's not necessarily religious. And if it is, then yes, you know, they have been touched by God, but they just have that thing that kind of cuts you, you know, mm-hmm. it touches you, you know, so
yeah.
We're lucky enough to grow up like that.
So that's the record collection, and I'm hoping you got to listen to it on your own whenever you wanted to, but was there...
I did.
So your mom trusted you?
No, she didn't. We were, no, like... You know, the record player was also, you know, it was a piece of, like, furniture / you know, the doilies and the plants and the figurines.
Sure, sure.
And so she would always yell at us and say, don't be scratching up my records. Don't be messing up my needle because it's hard to get those needles in properly. You remember that?
Yep.
And so she would yell at us, so my sister and I would memorize the setup. She would go out sometimes, you know, to get some time away and on a Friday or Saturday night, and we would memorize the setup of the doilies and the plants and the figurines, and then we'd have to put it back. So, no, she didn't trust me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's cool. Well, good for you. Do you remember the day when you realized that music was going to be the way that Annie Mac made her way in the world?
Oh, man. You know, sometimes I get emotional when I think about it. I came into music really, really late. I never sang anything, was never in a choir. Hmm. After my mother passed away, I thought I was more of a writer. So I was just kind of writing out all this stuff to kind of deal with some feelings and emotions and to try to make things right with my mother. And something happened where I thought, oh, man, it'd be cool to get up and do an open mic for poetry. Somehow, some way, I ended up doing an open mic in someone's garage,
mm-hmm.
trying to get through a song. I had a friend named Ralph Campbell that was like, I think you can sing. And I said, you think I can sing? He's like, yeah, I think there's something there. And I was horrible. I was really, really bad, but I was really excited to finally have something to hold on to that I was able to get some, you know, some healing, you know,
sure.
from that relationship with my mom, or to know how to process and deal with the death and transitioning to being a real adult, you know. And I don't know when it exactly happened, but I can tell you when it changed for me, my desire to really want to connect with people and to offer hope and understanding of what I know what it's like to go through some things. I was performing in Wisconsin a few years back, and I just was getting my legs as a live performer, and I wrote this song called Saving Grace about my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time, I didn't realize it, but it actually celebrates who she is. It's this beautiful spirit that I feel was given to me really as a saving grace, you know,
yeah.
to get me out of myself and for me to focus about loving on someone else and correcting kind of some generational stuff, you know, like with my mom. I realized that the cycle of dysfunction and abuse has stopped with me.
Mm.
I realized that in writing this is really a testimony to I get to love on my daughter, I get to support her, and I get to, you know, I kind of had to deal with a lot of those monsters associated with, you know, being a survivor of abuse and those things. And you don't know what you have to work on until you're presented with it, right?
Yeah.
That was happening, you know, with my daughter. And I was just kind of like, all right, I don't want her to be in fear of me. I don't want her. So I wrote this song. And anyway, a woman came up to me after the show, and she was actually by the stage bawling. And I said to her, meet me after the show. And she came on over, and she could hardly talk, and she's just crying. And her friend with her said, you know, her daughter just passed away about a year ago. That song is just so touching, and it's just so beautiful. And we can just picture, you know, her daughter. And that's when it clicked that, oh, this is what it's about for me.
Really?
I can't speak for anybody else. But if this woman was able to, if it was cathartic and she was able to get a little bit of healing and maybe be encouraged, you know, by remembering, it is sad, but just feeling like, man, I had her. And she embodied those same traits of being graceful and wise, and it's a really cool song, and that's what it's about. So my whole thing kind of changed. Even my performance, when I go out to perform, I'm prepared to give to the people beyond the stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm prepared to have people come up and talk to me. There's something that people are looking for that I'm lucky enough to be able to provide or point them in the direction, whatever. That's when things change for me.
Good stuff. And people are going to be feeling it Friday night the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, when you, the Annie Mac Band, brings its blues and gospel specialties to Wisconsin again.
And we're doing a really awesome acoustic show. We're doing a really cool, two guitars and upright bass. And we really are connecting. Like, we really are. This is going to be a really beautiful, intimate, you know, heavy on the music. You can still get the job done and not have to have all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, really excited to have fun. And it's not all heavy stuff, you know, have fun and have a really good time. But, you know, my hope is always that people leave feeling inspired and feeling like it's going to be all right.
You said that your mother had passed away, right?
Yes.
Well, I don't want to be insensitive.
I'm open.
Well, I don't want to sound morbid or anything, but did you get the record player?
I did. You know what? I got the record player.
Good.
Thank you so much for asking. You know, you totally get it because check this out. When she passed away, my biggest thing that I felt connected to, ironically enough, I gave it away. Because I said, you know, Annie, don't be a hoarder. And so when I was cleaning out her apartment, people don't talk about that part of, like, when you clean out your parents' place, and if they're from our, like, parents' era, you know what I mean, like, or older, like, there's a lot of practices that come along with being from that generation. And I'm just going to give word to that, but you're going to keep every damn thing. We don't need these National Geographics from 1978. So I said, Annie, keep the record, but get rid of the record player. And that was really tough for me.
I was going to comment on the name of your EP, which is Tell It Like It Is. I don't have to ask you why it was named that, because now I know that's what you do.
Yeah, I try to. You know, I try to deal with stuff that's real, but always leave it on the element of hope. It's just a song that celebrates my brothers and sisters who are pushing towards recovery and make the choice to be sober every day. And also for those, you know, that have transitioned on. It's really just like, man, you got to let people know. Sometimes we have to go back to that place to really appreciate where we are. That's what it's about.
Got me a house on the other side of town. Down by the railroad tracks. It ain't much, but it's all mine. Better than where I was at. I used to wander around Dope City. Crazy, not my mind. Down at the five and dime, and I made my way. I got to tell it like it is, and I ain't the same. Lord, I got to tell it like it is,
Well, I noticed that Minnesota Public Radio and NPR are media fans of Annie Mac, and now I want you to know that you can say that WPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, has joined the fan club. Annie Mac, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate everything, and I look forward to seeing everybody on Friday. It's going to be a lot of fun.
7:30 Friday, Heidi Center, cvca.net. That's the website. Or walk in and get a ticket at the door. One of the cool ways to spend a Friday night. Another is coming up a bit later in the program. Well, hey, theater companies are busy this time of year, as Jim Oliver will now certify.
The Laramie Project, a production of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Theater, will open tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, and continue to Saturday and the following Wednesday through Sunday at the Riverside Theater in the Haas Fine Arts Center at the University. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will present Once Upon a Witch through Sunday and next Friday through Sunday. Steel Magnolias will be staged by the River Falls Community Theater Friday and Saturday and the following Friday and Saturday in the River Falls Public Library. The Menominee Theater Guild will present Dracula Friday through Sunday in the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. Night Came Early will be presented Friday through Sunday by the Clear Lake Community Theater in the Clear Lake Area Community Center. Members of the Northern Lakes Theater Guild will present readings of scary stories and poems for Halloween on Saturday, October 27th in the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater of Hudson is staging same time next year, Fridays and Saturdays through October 27th. Little Women, a play based on the novel by Louisa May Alcott, will play Saturday and Sunday in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. The festival theater production will continue through October 27th. The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond is staging Johnny Appleseed for student audiences through Friday, and the Old Gem will stage The Frog Prince for general audiences through Saturday. The Rocky Horror Show will be staged October the 25th to the 27th by the Eau Claire Children's Theater in the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Enrichment Through Culture of Cumberland will present Packer Fans from Outer Space October the 25th to the 27th and November 1st through the 3rd in the Cumberland Arts Center. And the Phipps Center for the Arts has scheduled auditions for 84 Charing Cross Road for 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday and 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday in the Phipps of Hudson.
Well, you may have noticed we enjoy festivals in western Wisconsin. Over some years, the Chippewa Valley Book Festival has made an impressive name for itself. This week, Jim Oliver talks with one of the names helping put this year's event in a bright spotlight.
Caroline Fraser won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Biography or Autobiography and the 2017 National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography for Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Caroline Fraser will be one of the presenters in the Chippewa Valley Book Festival, which opened on the 15th and will continue through October 25th. Her event will be the second annual John Elizabeth and Allison Morris Memorial Event, sponsored by Greg Morris and the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Foundation. Caroline Fraser joins us by telephone from her home in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Thanks for having me.
You are also the editor of two volumes of the Library of America's Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Little House Books. Now, was that what got you started as a writer of Wilder's works, or had you been reading Laura Ingalls Wilder stuff forever?
Oh, you know, I started pretty much where everybody, or many people, do with Laura Ingalls Wilder, and that's when I read her books as a kid, read them over and over again. And after, you know, growing up and becoming a freelance writer and a literary scholar, I got an opportunity to write a fairly long article about Wilder and her books. And that was around the time when a biography of Wilder's daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a writer and novelist, came out. And that book set forth this kind of controversial claim that Rose was really the author of the Little House books, not her mother. So I kind of looked into that, and that was what led some years later to my editing the Library of America's volumes.
Sorry, but I'm not familiar with the Library of America's volumes. What does that consist of?
That's a series of books that's been published now for, I don't know, 25, 30 years, designed to bring all of the great classics of American literature, you know, not just fiction, but poetry and journalism and essays and so forth, back into print in volumes that are edited and that provide a background about the books as well. And it was in writing that chronology about Laura Ingalls Wilder that I really became interested in writing a new biography of her, because it just seemed that there was so much fascinating intersection between her life and the history of her time.
As I was reading through the book, I thought, my goodness, there's an awful lot of research went into this. And then I looked at the back of the book, and there's 85 pages, I think, of notes at the end of the manuscript. How long did the book take?
Well, you know, as I say, I've been working on this material for a while. I actually probably spent, you know, 5 or 6 years working on it full out, but the work that went into the Library of America volumes also gave me a real leg up on the project. Many people are kind of familiar with the books or even the TV show and have a sense that the family did, you know, sort of progress westward. But in reality, it was a more complicated and in some ways a kind of a harsher story than that. The family was quite poor, you know, as they are depicted in the books. They start out in Pepin, Wisconsin, and then there's a lot of moving back and forth to Missouri. They go to Kansas. They don't actually own property in Kansas, but they start building in the expectation that maybe they're going to be able to buy land there. They end up going back to Wisconsin because the farmer who had bought their property couldn't afford to pay for it. Then they go to Minnesota, where they're eaten out of house and home by this locust invasion, a major national disaster at the time. And that practically ruined the Ingalls family. They were actually homeless for a while and ended up moving back east again to Iowa and living in conditions that were really pretty poor and may have given rise to the illness that Mary would suffer from later that left her blind. So the family's poverty and their constant struggle to kind of find a better life is a kind of a different takeaway than you get from the novels, which all end happily. And of course, the Ingalls family did end up in Dakota Territory, have a number of struggles there. And Laura then married at 18 her beau, Almanza Wilder. And unfortunately, life did not get better for them. You know, they experienced a series of really tragic difficulties in their first years of marriage, lost crop after crop. They went into debt. They fell ill with diphtheria, and Almanzo suffered a stroke, which left him with a permanent disability. They lost a child. And then shortly after that, their house burned down. And that was really the event that made it impossible for them to stay in Dakota Territory, which I think they had wanted to do, you know, to be near her family. And in the end, they ended up moving to Mansfield, Missouri, and kind of starting over. A lot of the biography, Prairie Fires, does explore how they started over, how they were able to kind of reestablish themselves, and how Laura embarked on this career as a writer. I mean, she and Almanzo continued to farm, but she also had this career as a newspaper columnist for many years, then started writing her memoir. And when that didn't sell, she used the memoir as a kind of outline for the Little House books, which would eventually make her a fairly wealthy woman late in life.
Well, you mentioned her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who apparently was involved in her writing. It was believed that she was actually the person who wrote the Little House books and not Laura. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yes. Rose was certainly very central to her mother's work. Rose started out as a journalist in San Francisco in around 1915. And her mother came to visit her that year and began sort of apprenticing herself to her daughter, wanting to try to figure out how to write for farm journals and farm newspapers as a way to make extra money. Rose was very sophisticated. She developed a career, had an agent, sold a lot of stories and newspaper work. So her contribution was really to act as her mother's, you know, editor. You know, she really urged her to write what they called the story of your life thing, which Laura actually started quite early on, various versions of it, but didn't really have time to devote full time to it until she had retired from farming in the late 1920s. But the fact is that Laura did write all the original manuscripts for the books, the kind of dime store tablets she would get from just the local grocery and would write on them in pencil. They're fascinating to look at. She started, as I said, with her memoir and then adapted that to her children's books. And what happened between Laura and Rose is that Laura would then show these manuscripts to her daughter. Rose would go through them and ask a lot of questions, make a lot of suggestions, and sometimes actually rewrite some of the prose. Laura really learned how
to write fiction from Rose, learned how to write dialogue, you know, sort of create chapters. They had a very intensive working relationship. There's no doubt about it, but I don't think that you can actually say that Rose was the author of the books.
Well, we are talking to Caroline Fraser, who is the author of Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. About the time we found out you were coming here for the book festival, the American Library Association said that Wilder's use of derogatory language towards African Americans and Native Americans in her books is what prompted the organization to remove her name from a prestigious children's literature prize, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award. It's now called the Children's Literature Legacy Award. Do you agree with the association's decision?
You know, this was something that had been debated for a very long time among librarians. But it actually was a process that started even while Wilder was still alive, because in the 1950s, her publisher asked her to make various changes for a new uniform edition of the novels that was coming out, and to remove some of the language in Little Town on the Prairie, and to change a sentence in Little House on the Prairie. So this is something that has been kind of debated and knocked back and forth for a long time. That award was, of course, created specifically for Laura Ingalls Wilder by the Library Association to honor her life's work, and she was the first recipient of it. And I think that the association just came to feel over the years, as they got more and more, you know, questions and concerns from people who worked with children, that they did need to make some kind of change to the name of the award in order to acknowledge that there were these concerns out there. But they very specifically said that they didn't want this to be taken as any form of censorship, and that they weren't discouraging people from reading Wilder's work. And I take them at their word in that. I think they do want people to continue to read the books and have a relationship to the books. But they just felt that given that this was specifically for children's literature, that they needed it to reflect a kind of wider reality at the moment.
When I was a child on the farm before electricity and things like that, I read Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, which has some what would be considered inappropriate language at this day and age. Has anything similar been done to other authors like that, or is it because that was a book for adults, whereas the Little House books were more for children?
Yeah, I think it is because the Little House books are for children, and that teachers and librarians feel that they need to approach them in a slightly different way now, as opposed to, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, when teachers would make a very common practice of reading the books to their classrooms. So I don't know about the names of any other awards, but clearly this is an issue that comes up with all of literature. You know, everything that's written before the present day has issues that are similar to this, and I think that for adults, it's not so much of an issue, because, you know, you just have to understand more about the history of the time and the ways that people, you know, the kind of language that's used in previous periods, and you have to learn about that as you're reading. But I think for children, it's a little bit of a trickier issue.
Well, the book is Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. We've been talking to the author, Caroline Fraser, who will be talking about her book at a presentation for the Chippewa Valley Book Festival at 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 23rd in the RCU Theater in the Pablo Center at the Confluence in downtown Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can go to the book festival's website. Caroline, thanks so much for talking to us. I hope that people will go, because they're going to be really educated by this presentation, I'm sure, as I have been for this last few minutes.
It's been great to talk to you.
CVBookFest.org is the website. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, collections comprised of art inspired by water from European and American masters, including Picasso, Audubon, and others. More about the museum at mmam.org. Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, offering fair trade gifts and a space for meetings, retreats, or classes in their historic schoolhouse overlooking the Red Cedar Valley. Simply-dunn.com. I'm not sure I've heard anyone play the horn any better. And all the people who enlist his services on albums and soundtracks and guest concerts agree. Wayne Bergeron is about as good as it gets. See what I mean? Well, the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra gets to play with As Good As It Gets Friday evening in Eau Claire. So we caught him on the other West Coast on the phone just after exiting one of those sought-after recording sessions in his car. And on the way to another. Well, we all know here Los Angeles as the tinsel town that it is, but you grew up there, and we hear stories about how musicians got their starts in small grade schools with the luxury of one-on-one tutoring from a favorite teacher, playing concerts for moms and dads, kind of the Pleasantville story. But our imaginations would picture L.A. to be different than that, a faster lane, maybe more frills and less personal. Is that stereotype wrong? Did you grow as a musician in the same slow, kind of natural way that small-town kids did?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when people think of Los Angeles, they immediately think of Hollywood and the industry. And I had a band in junior high school and had a really great band director, and who I probably learned more from than any teacher I ever had.
Yeah.
It was probably my first trumpet teacher and my junior high band director. I still draw on his information, as a matter of fact, to this day.
Did those guys see something in you? Did they say, Wayne, you've got something here?
I had a little bit of natural ability on the trumpet when I was young, so they did see that, and I was able to just do some things early on that it takes other people maybe a little longer to grasp, especially with as far as the range of the trumpet. I was able to play kind of high notes as a kid, and I was blessed or cursed with it, however you want to look at it. I did have a little bit of a head start on this, and so it's what kept me interested, because I go, hey, I can do something, you know, that some of the other kids can't do.
Sure.
When I studied with my junior high band director, and I studied with him through high school for kind of off and on, he'd assign me things to practice that I probably didn't always practice, but I was kind of going on natural ability, and it wasn't until really later, as I got a little bit older, that I started getting more serious about it. As I started, you know, as you get a little bit older, you start running into other players that can do what you can do, and that can also do things you can't do, and you realize, oh, boy, I missed the boat here on some stuff. So you just start going after it and working at it a little harder. So I was a little bit of a late bloomer that way, and I wish somebody would have kicked me in the seat of the pants when I was a little younger and said, hey, look, you have to practice. You know, you're good, but you're not that good. You know?
Yeah. Let's fast forward a number of years and get to your late 20s when you were lead trumpet in a band led by an iconic trumpet player. Maynard Ferguson complimented you by calling you very musical. What does that mean? Because at first glance, I would think musical would be a given.
Well, you know, some bands, especially Maynard's band, was more of a raucous band. So, you know, was a very edgy, loud band. You know, it wasn't that it wasn't musical. It was just a different kind of musical. Where I try to think a little looser. I try to make sure we're doing all the nuance we can do. And even though it was like an edgy band, you know, I tried to bring nuance to the table as well, so the edginess would have contrast to maybe some more subtleties. You know, and so that's kind of where I go musically speaking anyway. It's where we should all go, but doesn't mean everybody does that necessarily,
yeah.
You know. I learned how to play a lot of different styles of music when I was young, too, and so he might have been referring to that because we played a couple of dances and things when I was on the band, which we didn't do very much, and we had to play some old-timey kind of stuff. And so I was, my teacher kind of showed me a lot about that, and I did a lot of listening, so I knew how to change styles. And I think he was referring to that more than anything, probably.
You've played concerts and sessions with a list of musical who's who that is almost too long to name. How does a horn player adapt to all those different styles? Or do you, after you've learned your chops, do they allow you to be yourself and add to the style, or what?
Well, I mean, you kind of learn, you know, the style of music you're playing. And, you know, if I'm going in and doing a big band swing record with an artist, it kind of is what it is, you know. We might get a little bit of direction. They go, hey, we want this to sound like this kind of a Sinatra-esque record, you know, that might have taken place in the late 60s. There's a sound and there's a way the band played time. And even though it's kind of all the same, there is a little bit of a difference. You know, maybe the notes are a little thicker and fatter sounding. So I kind of try to adapt that way. If they said this takes place in the 40s, you know, we're doing something that's more period, I would approach the music a little differently. The time feel is a little different. It's a little more on top of the beat. The vibrato is faster. Things like that, there's little subtleties. And you know, if I'm playing in a rock situation, that I'm not going to use any vibrato. You know, it's going to be more blocked out. And or funk music, the notes are going to be really short in the time. So I've always kind of been a big believer in that. Teacher told me, he goes, you go to where the music is. You go to the era of the music, and you try to be as authentic as you can be to the style of music you're playing,
oh, yeah.
No matter what that is.
Great
it was
advice.
A good lesson that I got, and I didn't realize it at the time, what great advice that was, because what I do for a living now, you know, is I do recording sessions, and I never know what I'm going to see when I walk into work.
Sure.
It could be today, for instance, this Green Eggs and Ham series I'm doing, this Dr. Seuss thing, is all over the map stylistically. It's like cartoon music, you know. So one minute we're playing very classical, next minute we're playing really wacky kind of cartoon stuff. It goes swing, it goes very orchestral, and it's from, you know, in my three bars, and it's changing styles constantly. Like that advice he gave me, and that the things he had me listen to have come in handy in as far as my career here.
Yeah,
you know?
No kidding. So, let's jump to appearances like the one you're going to experience Friday night. I picture this kind of activity in the same way I remember my grandma saying, be sure to save room for dessert. Talk a bit about what coming to places like Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and mingling with university students. I know that you're on the faculty of a university, but you travel around and talk with young people and play with them. That kind of thing, does that smooth the edges of a hectic schedule for you? Does it add to the guy, the musician that Wayne Bergeron is? What do things like this do for you?
Well, actually, to be honest with you, you know, this kind of side of my career, I probably enjoy it more than what I do here. I mean, as much as I love doing session work and all stuff, which is great, and it's going out and playing live and getting to work with college students or high school students and getting to do these things is actually a bit more satisfying. The travel part of it is not as fun. It's always a grind, getting up early, getting on a plane. But once I'm there, I can count on one hand the bad experiences I've had, maybe for whatever reason or another. It's usually such a positive thing that I enjoy very much. And I get treated well, of course, and I like meeting new musicians and meeting new players and watching other college, you know, educators teach. I always learn something from that, you know. And so when I'm doing a master class on something, there's little bits and pieces of stuff I probably stolen from everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we steal our information from everybody and we mold it into our own, you know. So it's, for me, it's still, you know, I'm learning as well. You know, I'm not out just teaching. I'm learning as I go and trying to evolve as a teacher and a player and an entertainer. And so I love doing it. I get, in a nutshell, I enjoy it very much.
I've heard people love it as well. One final inquiry. You've also designed horns and mouthpieces. So in the realm of horn playing, you really have done it all. Or have you? Is there anything left on the smorgasbord that you haven't tried yet or would like to?
You know, not really. I mean, I think that I feel extremely fortunate to have the career. You know, not many people get to do what they love. And I love to play, and the fact that I get to blow down this tube every day, and somebody's going to pay me for it, first of all. And it's an artistic endeavor, and I get to do so many different kinds of things. I mean, I never take it for granted one bit that not everybody gets to do this. And I've gotten to play with a lot of great people and doing a lot of really amazing things and meet mentors that I only heard about in high school and getting to work with them later in life. But, like, Jones and even Sammy Nestico, who you may not know that name, but as a jazz musician, Sammy Nestico, when I was growing up, all the high school jazz bands and stuff were playing Sammy Nestico's chart. He wrote for Count Basie in the late 60s and into the 70s, and a lot of their the records we're putting out were Sammy Nesko charts. So I would see these, this name, Sammy Nesko, on these charts. And later in life here, now he's 94 years old, he's a dear friend of mine, and I've played three different or four different projects with him. And so for me, even though he's not the biggest name, it's like, I feel like I've made it. Like, oh, man, Sammy Nesko, man, I'm playing. And it's kind of a fun thing. And I have one of his charts that featured me that he wrote a little note on and signed to me, proudly displayed in my studio, that says, to Wayne Bergeron, my favorite trumpet player on the planet. And I'm probably more proud of that little piece of paper than anybody I've ever played for. That's a big deal to me. But it's fun, man. It's a fun, you know, it's a fun thing I get to do, and I'll never tire of it, I don't think. Oh, you'll probably have to wrestle this thing out of my, to quote Charlton Heston, you'll have to wrestle this trumpet out of my cold, dead hands.
Yeah.
You know.
You'll hear some of that coming Friday night. You'd be surprised to know how many television and movie themes feature his horn playing, and he said he might have a new recording coming out around next summer. So we'll be listening for that. Wayne Bergeron alive with the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. It's a reunion, and it's going to be remarkable. Friday night, Jamp Theater, thepablocenter.org is that website. Don't forget the River Falls Main Street Art Crawl is Saturday from 10 to 4. 14 artists at 9 businesses. RiverFallsCAB.org. Saturday, the Silver Dome Ballroom just west of Neillsville hosts the 2018 Blues Party. Tribute to Muddy Waters. Music starts at 4. The website there is SilverDomeBallroom.net. Friday, there's a concert featuring Todd Harper and June Miyake as part of an annual autumnal music ecology tour. The theme is ending the War on Trees. You can call 864-7072 for details and directions. 864-7072. Rachel, Kate, and Dean deserve our thanks for backstage operations. Your standing with this program is unequaled, simply because without you, there'd be no us. Thank you for that. Next week, Valley Art Association Gallery, Big Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra Concert, library enhancements, and more. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. See you then.